The UN Security Council extends a cross-border aid operation to Syria from Turkey for the next 12 months. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society says that over 400 Palestinians have been injured in Israeli forces' attacks on anti-settlement protesters near Nablus. And thousands of Argentinian farmers rally in Buenos Aires to protest the government's policies on the agricultural sector. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. And now the UN Security Council has agreed to extend an aid operation in Syria through a border crossing with Turkey for another 12 months.
Today, we are witnessing a historical moment. For the first time, Russia and the United States not only managed to find an agreement, but to present a joint text which was supported by all our colleagues in the Council. We expect that this kind of day will become a turning point, that not only Syria will win from this, but the whole Middle Eastern region and the world as a whole.
The resolution was passed following last-minute negotiations between Russian UN Ambassador Vasily Nebenzia and his U.S. counterpart Linda Thomas-Greenfield. Turkey welcomed the extension. Russia had previously rejected an extension of aid operations through Bab al-Hawa border crossing, arguing that the move will benefit terrorists in Syria's Idlib province and violate the country's sovereignty. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for additional funding and more border crossings for aid deliveries into Syria. Political commentator Judith Bello says the West seeks to divide Syria and that the UN humanitarian aid is a Trojan horse which only benefits terrorists instead of the Syrian people.
When you're talking about Al-Qaeda, this has consistently been an issue. It was an issue in Aleppo that the terrorists received the money and the medical aid and the food, and the people were not permitted to partake of it. So there's a lot of issues here, and the West is papering over them because they want to maintain the division in Syria. They want to maintain an occupation of Syria. They want to divide the country. And this humanitarian so-called aid is actually, a Trojan horse to bring in further, to continue the war, to bring in further division into the country.
The Palestinian Red Crescent Society says over 400 Palestinians have been injured after Israeli forces attacked anti-settlement protesters near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Regime forces used live rounds and rubber-coated bullets, as well as tear gas, against the demonstrators. Clashes erupted in the town of Kusra and on Mount Sabi in the town of Beita, where people took to the streets against an illegal settlement outpost, Eviatar, demanding its removal. Now, the outpost has become one of the focal points of recent clashes between settlers backed by regime forces and the Palestinians. Several Palestinians have been killed and dozens wounded in violence over the past several weeks. Beita residents have pledged to continue their protests until the outpost is removed. We are earlier joined by our correspondent, Mona Candil, for an update on Israel's latest crackdown against anti-settlement protesters in the occupied West Bank.
Well, today, after the Friday prayers, Palestinians protested against the illegal outpost of Aviatar that was built on Palestinian land on the Mount of the Sabih, part of the Beita village in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Last week, Israeli settlers left the outpost after reaching an agreement with the Israeli regime that they will leave the outpost. However, the outpost itself, the homes would remain there, and the Israeli military must protect the buildings there and consider it as a military base. Palestinians have rejected this. They are insisting that the outpost should be completely removed, and the Israeli military should leave the Mount Sabiha Heder. What happened today? The Palestinians demonstrated their calling for the removal of the Abiatar outpost. They clashed with the Israeli forces. According to Palestinian Ministry of Health, we are speaking about over 400 Palestinians were wounded.
A UN human rights investigator says that Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank meet the definition of a war crime under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court.
In my report, I conclude that the Israeli settlements do amount to a war crime. I submit to you that this finding compels the international community to assess the plentiful accountability measures on its diplomatic and legal menu, and to make it clear to Israel that its illegal occupation and its defiance of international law and international opinion can and will no longer be cost-free.
And Michael Link said the settlements violate an absolute ban on an occupying force transferring part of its civilian population into an occupied territory. Link also slammed as both unlawful and heartless Israel's demolition of Bedouin tent dwellings in a village in the West Bank this last Wednesday. He said that progressive seizures of Palestinian land together with the protection of settlements is further consolidation of Israel's de facto annexation of the West Bank. Link is the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Occupied Palestinian Territories. He was addressing a session of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. EU ambassador to the UN in Geneva also said all settlements are illegal under international law.
Settlements are illegal under international law. The EU's position on Israel's settlement policy and activities, including in East Jerusalem, is well known. Such actions as forced transfers, evictions, demolitions, and confiscations of homes will only escalate an already tense environment.
Israel had boycotted the UN Human Rights Council session, while its closest ally, the U.S., did not speak at the forum. More than 680,000 Israelis live in nearly 300 settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds. Israel has recently stepped up settlement activities backed by the U.S. and in defiance of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2334. Now, all Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Palestinians want to establish an independent state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, with East Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital. However, settlements on occupied land have long been a stumbling block to the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Political commentator John Stepling says Israel is aware of the fact that the UN has no power to enforce its resolutions on Tel Aviv over its illegal settlements.
Since 1980, there have been, I think, something like 200 resolutions from the General Assembly, the Security Council, et cetera, and the UN, all of them condemning Israeli actions as being in violation of international law. Michael Link is a legal scholar, and he has written very cogently and correctly about the violations in terms of international law, and he says the only road to resolving the illegal occupation and the brutality of Israeli crimes is to set a precedent where you follow international law. Now, that's not going to happen because Israel doesn't care what the UN says, and the UN has no power whatsoever to enforce any of its resolutions or positions.
The Taliban says that they have seized Afghanistan's key border crossing with Turkmenistan amid a blistering offensive by the militant group. Earlier, we discussed this issue at length in our news review program. Here it is. The Taliban says that they have seized Afghanistan's key border crossing with northern neighbor Turkmenistan amid a blistering offensive by the militant group. A Taliban spokesman said the Torghundi border port had been fully captured. Afghan's Interior Ministry said that security forces at the port had been temporarily relocated. It added that efforts are underway to recapture the crossing. Russia also said that the militant group controls more than two-thirds of the Tajik border in the northeast. Moreover, the Taliban captured Afghanistan's main conduit for trade with Iran in the west. The Taliban claimed to be in control now of 85% of the country. Afghan authorities, though, have dismissed that figure and vowed to retake all the districts lost to the militants. U.S. says it will complete its withdrawal from Afghanistan by August 31st after invading the country 20 years ago. And now joining us for the program is Mr. Amin Adani from Kabul and Mr. Frank Emsbach, Emeritus Professor from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, joining us from Madison, Wisconsin. Hello, gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you both joining us here on the program. Start there with you for the latest. These figures, 85% in the country in such a short period of time, could it be true or is it an exaggeration?
Well, according to the Taliban militant group, the militants have control over 85% of the Afghan territory, a claim that has been rejected by Afghan officials here in Kabul. For instance, Afghanistan's Interior Ministry spokesman Tariq Aryan, in response to such claim by the Taliban, and additionally in response to a word that the Taliban had said that we have the capability to bring all 34 provinces of Afghanistan under our own control in 15 days, Aryan had said that the Taliban will never be able to gain control permanently over even small cities across Afghanistan. According to the spokesperson of Afghanistan's Interior Ministry, the Taliban are not acting, behaving, or operating independently.
So, Frank, welcome to the program. Your initial thoughts on what's going on. And yesterday, Joe Biden, the U.S. president, said that it's time for us to leave the country. We've achieved our mission there. And my question to you, what was that mission? Now we're seeing the situation, the security situation on the ground in Afghanistan. Was that mission to turn the country on its head and then split?
Well, the mission changed over 20 years, and I think President Biden is accurate about that. Initially, it was a mission of revenge. Even after the Afghan government just simply refused to cave in instantaneously to the United States' demand, we were blaming the Afghans for the attack on the United States with 9/11, even though all the people were Saudis. So that's why we invaded. And we said, well, we'll overthrow the government, and we don't like the Taliban, and so we're going to try to put in our own people. Our group in Afghanistan never had a real base or popular support. And that's not to say the Taliban necessarily did either. And I don't think we can discuss any of this without looking into the past a little bit, where the U.S. Financed via Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and the most retrograde parts of Afghan society, the overthrow of a reasonably progressive government there. So all these chickens have come home to roost, but I think Biden is accurate. The mission changed. It was really crazy. It wasted time, money, treasure, people's lives, accomplished nothing except the death of thousands of people and the destruction of large parts of the country, and the putting of opium as the major export product of Afghanistan, which is what we've done every place we've invaded. So that's what happened, and I think he's finally said we're not going to do it anymore, which is a plus.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Time has gotten the better of us. It was a great show, though. Amin Adani joining us here out of Kabul, and Mr. Frank Emsbach, professor from the University of Wisconsin. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Iran's foreign ministry says the country's border with Afghanistan is secure after the Taliban captured Afghanistan's main conduit for trade with its eastern neighbor. The ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, stressed there is no insecurity at the border between the two countries. He noted that due to confrontations in Islam Qala and Abu Nasser Farahi customs, a group of Afghan customs employees had to enter Iran. Now on Friday, the Taliban captured Islam Qala and Afghanistan's Herat province. The border between Iran and Afghanistan runs about 900 kilometers, and Islam Qala is one of three crossings between the two countries. Thousands of Argentinian farmers rally in Buenos Aires province, that is, to protest the government's policies on the agricultural sector. Grain farmers and cattle ranchers marched in San Nicolas to condemn what they called state intervention in their markets. Demonstration was organized by local rural associations. They demand an end to the government's bans on beef exports as a way of controlling inflation, which is expected to hit 50% this year. Farmers say ban is doing significant damage to the beef industry in the country, which is one of the world's largest exporters. They're also angered by the government's separate plans to raise taxes and limit exports of wheat and corn. Brazil's total coronavirus infections have surpassed 19 million as nations logged over 57,700 cases in the past 24 hours. South African countries also registered over 1,500 new daily deaths. Brazil faces the world's second deadliest COVID outbreak after the U.S., with a total death toll of over 500,000. Meanwhile, a new poll shows the disapproval rating of the country's president has reached an all-time high of 52%. Jair Bolsonaro's administration has been under fire over its mishandling of the coronavirus pandemic, as well as corruption allegations involving the purchase of COVID vaccines. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. People under the age of 65 living in the most deprived areas of the United Kingdom were more than 3.7 times more likely to die with COVID than people in the richest areas. We have prepared for you an article authored by Patrick Butler under the heading COVID death risk almost four times higher for poorest in England. We'll be right back. inquiry into the health impact of the coronavirus pandemic has found that chances of dying from COVID-19 were nearly four times higher for adults of working age in England's poorest areas than for those in the wealthiest places. The nine-month inquiry by the Health Foundation charity said a decade of widening health inequalities and cuts to public services had frayed the nation's health and contributed to the United Kingdom's disproportionately high COVID death toll compared with similar countries. It called for urgent action to reduce health differences and urged significant public investment in the National Health Service, the NHS, in jobs, housing, education, communities and social security. It warned there must be no reboot of austerity policies of the past decade as the United Kingdom prepared to move out of the pandemic. Joe Bibby, the Foundation's Director of Health, said, "We may have to learn to live with COVID-19, but we don't have to live with its unequal impact." She added, "We cannot afford to make the same mistake twice." The report echoes many of the findings of the public health expert Sir Michael Marmot's report into COVID health inequalities in Greater Manchester, published recently, and reflects increasing concerns over the scale and focus of the government's plans for the United Kingdom's long-term recovery from the coronavirus pandemic. The chair of the inquiry, Dame Claire Moriarty, said, "We need to aim for a recovery that builds economic and social resilience, with levelling up not limited to geographical areas of disadvantage, but that addresses the needs of groups who have experienced the most damaging impacts of the pandemic." In her introduction to the report, Dame Claire Moriarty wrote, "The legacy of the pandemic is all around us in unmet health need, mental health problems, gaps in educational attainment, loss of employment, and financial insecurity. If we are to avoid these becoming long-term scars, it's time to confront our choices about how we value people." There have been more than 150,000 excess deaths in the United Kingdom during the pandemic. The inquiry said the single biggest factor in the spread of COVID in the United Kingdom was the timing of lockdowns and the stringency of restrictions. The report added, "Once the virus had spread, the extent to which different groups were affected reflected variations in underlying health and socioeconomic factors that increase risk of exposure and worse outcomes." The inquiry found high COVID death rates in the poorest areas were driven in part by poor pre-existing health problems. People aged 50 to 69 in the 10% most deprived neighbourhoods of the United Kingdom were more than twice as likely to have long-term conditions that put them at higher risk, such as diabetes and chronic lung conditions. Jobs and occupations including caring, manufacturing and leisure industry also increased the risk of exposure to the virus, as did poor housing conditions. Going into the pandemic, overcrowding in private and social rented housing in England was at its highest recorded level. As well as being highest in deprived areas, COVID mortality rates were higher for certain groups, such as care home residents, disabled people, and ethnic minority communities. Young people suffered disproportionately high levels of mental illness. The inquiry said this was a landmark opportunity to rebuild public services and reduce widening health inequalities and declining life expectancy across the United Kingdom. The report added, "A recovery that puts increasing and fair opportunities for good health as a priority will need action to deal with the conditions that lead to poor health in the first place. The inquiry noted adequate income, good quality jobs and housing were necessary ingredients for good health. The report added, the decline in improvement in health life expectancy partly reflects the erosion of these social conditions in the United Kingdom in the decade preceding the coronavirus pandemic, affecting certain groups to a greater extent. The inquiry said the pandemic had laid bare the weaknesses of policy decisions made after the 2008 financial crash to drastically reduce public spending. This meant when COVID struck, public services were in a weakened state, and the health and financial resilience of many poorer households had been drastically weakened. It said the widening of health inequalities in the United Kingdom over the past decade had exposed the United Kingdom to a high death toll and reduced people's ability to deal with the subsequent economic shock. Meanwhile, a new report from the King's Fund warns obesity is fast becoming a disease of England's poorest people, putting them at higher risk of dying from the biggest killer diseases. The think tank says there is a stark and widening gap between the number of people from deprived families who are dangerously overweight and those from better-off backgrounds, and the difference is particularly pronounced amongst women. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson had identified tackling obesity as a key objective after realising how dangerous it can be when he was hospitalised last year with COVID. Sir Simon Stevens, the head of the National Health Service England, has sounded the alarm about rising obesity, describing it as the new smoking for its potential to harm public health. Richard Murray, the King Fund's chief executive, said, obesity is increasingly a disease of the poorest people and is damaging the life chances of children in the poorest parts of England, and increasingly as they go into adulthood, adding, the failure to grip the growing obesity crisis in poor parts of England will condemn people to a higher chance of diabetes, heart disease and some forms of cancer. It will inflict an increasing burden on them as individuals and on the National Health Service. The think tank highlights a significant increase in obesity in the most deprived communities in England in recent years, leading to a widening gap between the poor and affluent areas. For example, the gap in rates of obesity amongst women in the most and least deprived areas grew from 11% in 2014 to 17% in 2020. Data from the National Child Measurement Programme shows the gap has worsened among children too. The difference in obesity rates between the poorest and richest 10 and 11 year olds in primary schools increased from 8% in 2006-2007 to 13% in 2019-2020. Richard Murray, the King Fund's chief executive, said this underlines the need for government to tackle deep and widening inequalities which the pandemic has exposed, as part of its declared aims of levelling up and building back better after COVID, and efforts to reduce obesity in poor areas will be a key test. A government spokesperson said, we're absolutely committed to levelling up health inequalities across the country as part of our recovery from COVID-19. Through our obesity strategy and the recently announced ban on advertising of unhealthy foods, we're taking concrete steps to get the nation fit and healthy and protect the long-term health of our children.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality, brought to you by the one and only IRB English Radio. In the studio with me, I have the pleasure and honor of hosting two wonderful guests. To my left is
Muzaffar Haider from the UK.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, bro.
Wa alaikum salam.
Thank you for joining us. And to the right of the ring,
Hassanain from India. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so very much, you guys, for being with us. I'm Zainab. We are going to be talking about something that I was really passionate to bring up. What do you think is the best job and lifestyle for introverts and extroverts? Brother Hassanain, do you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
It depends on upon the like different situations.
No, generally yourself. I mean, obviously not.
Okay, I consider myself as an extrovert.
Yeah, I consider you as an extrovert too. Brother Lafayette.
I don't know. I really
you
don't
are
know.
Definitely an extrovert.
No, I'm not.
No, you're a tired extrovert, is what you are.
That's it. I'm a tired extrovert. I am so tired of being extroverted. I'm an introvert.
Yeah, and then you're slowly, as you get closer to, as 30 dawns upon you, you are slowly but surely.
I'm retreating into my shell. Yeah.
Crawling your way into the introvert line.
Yeah, I'm starting to sound like you, actually, sister. I'm starting to say things like, I hate people.
I would rather not interact with them. No.
That's what all extroverts think about the introverts. Like, they hate people.
We don't hate people, right? I personally suffer from acute social anxiety.
Self-diagnosed.
No, it's actually not. I was on medication and everything. And it comes to a surprise to everyone.
Self-prescribed?
It comes as a surprise to people because they think I come across as cheerful and bubbly and sociable when I'm doing a show. But then, ladies and gentlemen, for the record, let me clarify officially, it's called Acting. Jazz Hands. It's a show, for God's sake. It's called a show. The name is there. You put on a show.
Yeah.
This is not how I really am because I'm socially awkward. But anyway, I feel that this is one of the best jobs an introvert can have because it's kind of like being online. You know, introverts are very extroverted when they're online.
That's really surprising, sister, because I would have thought that your job, you know, being a radio host, is very much an extroverted job.
But I don't meet any people.
You know,
I used to sing.
You think of
a similar way, yeah.
Yeah, a TV presenter or, I don't know, any kind of media personality. It's about people.
Yeah, it's about performing for the people. You don't deal or engage or meet the people. They see you from behind their TV screen or from their radios. They listen to you, but there's no direct interaction.
Okay, what I've seen, when it was a solo show, you're just sitting and talking with the mic.
Yeah, it's like my comfort zone. It's literally my safe place. But just for the record and for argument's sake, let's define. This is one of my favorite things to do. Let's define introvert and extrovert. What do you think introvert and extrovert is, Brother Hassan? No, don't you dare.
Introverts, people, they love, you know, living alone. Like, they don't like mingling up with the people.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's it. An extrovert, they can, mingle with anyone they find, any stranger. They find a guy, hey, what's up? And they start there, conversing with
them. As an introvert, I have to say that even the definition of extroverts give me anxiety. Do you think it's just about being able to interact with other human beings?
Yeah, I guess it's introvert and extrovert is mostly about the engagement,
mm-hmm.
like with different people.
Right. Okay, my internet isn't budging. What's the definition for introvert and extrovert?
So extrovert is an outgoing, socially confident person.
Oh, I have the social confidence of a moldy potato.
Oh, come on.
I really do.
No. So you see, I'm an extrovert now.
Look, let me tell you the truth, sister.
Oh, what's an introvert? What's the definition?
Introvert is a shy, reticent person. Look, let me tell you the truth. It's all about acting.
It is.
Nobody in the public eye is ever not acting.
Duh.
If I was not acting in front of people, you would be terrified of me.
We wouldn't sit in the same room with you.
You would just be like, stay away from him. Mm. Everybody is, to an extent, acting. Mm. That sounds really, really like...
No, but it's natural.
So then, I was right at the beginning, like, it depends upon different situations, right?
Yeah, no, my point was that Sister considers herself as introverted.
But extrovert, see, here's the key element, all right? Let me just slide this in. The key element is that extroverts enjoy the company of other people, right? If you don't enjoy it, you're acting, you're not actually an extrovert. You're just, you know, you're forced to live the lifestyle that you don't enjoy. And an introvert actively enjoys the company of themselves over all other people. And they have a selective number of individuals with whom they enjoy mingling. That number is very limited. Again, very limited, but they're still out there. So that's, I think, the key factor in being an extrovert and being an introvert.
Okay,
introverts just enjoy their own company more. Yeah. Extroverts, on the other hand, get bored if they're alone.
Okay, Lan, what do you say? Like I might be... introvert for you, I might be extrovert for him.
No. See, that's another difference. Just because you enjoy other people's company as an extrovert doesn't mean that you don't hate some people. Some people are still annoying to you. Some people still irk you. Some people still get on your nerves. It's natural. But in general, you'd rather be with someone than be with yourself all alone. But as an introvert, I can full hand on my heart say that there isn't a time in the day where I don't feel like, okay, I want to go home.
No, I think I'm an introvert. If that's how you're defining it, then I'm definitely an introvert. I don't want people at all. I just want to be on my own.
I want to be on my own.
And I'm
exactly.
not getting any time on my own.
Yeah, because you're a father now.
Yes. So
for the rest of your life, you will never have time on your own ever again. Ever.
Right, yeah, exactly. So I think a human being will try and figure out a way to be on their own even while being with people. So then you can kind of... You'll be with people, but you're kind of retreating in your mind.
Exactly. Like, if I'm in a social gathering, I'm usually quiet. I crack a joke here or there, but usually they're very sarcastic snides. My head is always either in my cell phone or in my book. I usually get comments and jabs about it, that Zainab, you're not engaging with us, and this and that. And I either pretend not to hear it at all, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So now that we've established that extroverts... like to be with other, like they enjoy socializing, while introverts, okay, I'm just saying this as an introvert, I'm no expert, and introverts enjoy being alone. What do you think is the best career line? Okay, lifestyle is up to you, you do you, boo, it's none of my business, but what was the best career line for them? We'll be back after a short break, so stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
You, Brother Muldafar, as an ex-extrovert now leaning toward introverticy.
Introverts should have office jobs. They should be in a little box.
Cubicle.
The corporate cubicle jobs.
And they should just be in front of their desk. They only have to interact with somebody when their boss comes and says, have you met the deadline? You say yes or no.
What about that report I asked for?
Can you email me? And I'll answer you.
Exactly.
You know,
don't talk to me.
Introverts, right?
We can never hold eye contact, by
desk
the way,
job.
Either.
You know, you're happy. You're just right there. You put a little picture of your grandmother on the right. I don't know.
Or a
cat.
Dog.
Yeah, introverts.
Or cat, yeah.
Cats
introvert
people.
Usually
cat people.
Cat people.
Right? Yeah, because, But yeah, not a media job. Media is for extroverted people. It's for people... Hey, you, what's up? Wow, you know, that kind of person. If you're acting, you're gonna self-destruct eventually. You're just gonna be like, I don't want to do this job eventually, right? You're just going to blow up.
You look,
I think acting becomes a part of you eventually. And then ta-da, you're interacting with people. Because I think it gives you the means to socially interact while still... feeling that...
Maintaining my bubble.
Yeah, there you go, right.
Yes, thank you, doctor. Brother Hassanain?
Actually, I had the same answer as Brother Muzaffar. Like, you know, introverts, they should definitely have an office job, like in the closed rooms with the computers.
They're claustrophobic. Or maybe they could have jobs that doesn't... They could be morticians. Yes, they could work at morgues. They wouldn't have to interact with a single living soul. That's a perfect job for an introvert.
Have you heard this story?
Or a dog walker.
Do you know, they can be writers.
Yes, even better. Writers. That's actually my side
writers.
Job. I'm a writer.
That's a good one. Yeah, yeah. You know, dead bodies sometimes release some gas.
Yeah, and they go, ugh.
Yeah, so there was this mortician, and one of the dead bodies did that. And he died of a heart attack because scared him so much. It just, imagine you pull out this dead body.
Huh? Was he a greenhorn?
I don't know, but he pulled out this drawer, his dead body's there, you know, it looks creepy, and then he turns around, and then it just goes...
Brother Hassanain, so now that, at the beginning of the show, I identified you as a definite extrovert, right?
Yeah.
You enjoy other people's company.
Yeah.
You enjoy mingling.
Yeah, but it sort of depends upon...
You don't have to enjoy everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, some people are just downright annoying, whether you're an extrovert or an introvert, that person is annoying, right? Do you think your lifestyle and your career path is in accordance with your extroverted personality?
Yes, I do.
How so? Give me examples. And whether you actively chose it.
Okay, so I live in the dorms, and I live with different students, so, you know, that from different countries, so get to see different people, different cultures. So, like, we hang out with different people. So that was actually cool. So... You know, and like while studying and all, you have to interact with different people. Yeah, that's it.
My boy's from Hyderabad. That's my that's my city back in India, right?
Yeah.
Very social city.
Yeah,
everybody's
it
like,
is.
Hey, you know, they love each other. They're all like friendly
so
and
all
stuff.
So all Hyderabadis, I'm not trying to sound racist or stereotypical. All our Hyderabadis.
Sociable?
Yeah.
I haven't met a Hyderabadi who's not sociable.
Yeah, most of them are.
Interesting. And you enjoy it, right?
Yeah.
Did you actively choose this path for yourself because of your personality?
Well, you know, I chose this path, like, just, you know, to gain knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
For.
But you happen to enjoy it as well.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, because I remember when I chose this path for the same reason, knowledge, I didn't enjoy it. But alhamdulillah, ala kulli hal, I ain't complaining.
Yeah.
I'm saying I'm not enjoying, not that it was bad. Brother Muzaffar, as an ex-extrovert leaning toward introvertism, are you creating any changes in your life to cater better to your now developing personality?
Damn, that is a good question. How do I even answer that? Like, what kind of changes? What do you mean? Yes.
And
I haven't figured out what they
are
yet.
I'm asking you, what kind of changes? Do you feel like your life is turning on a new heel with this change that you're experiencing within yourself with age? Or is it just driving you crazy because your lifestyle is still extroverted, but now you're leaning toward being an introvert?
Yeah, no, I think I'm changing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm implementing changes consciously. Yes, I think I am. I'm keeping a bit more of a space
mm-hmm.
around
Are
me.
Are you enjoying it?
Am I enjoying the space? A little bit. It gives you some thinking room, I guess.
Does it scare you?
Yes. Yes, it does. It's a comfortable fear. My role model when I was growing up was Peter Pan. One
I thought
of them
it was Jack Sparrow.
Jack Sparrow.
Do
Peter
I even
Pan.
Know you anymore?
Oh no. Peter Pan. Only I don't like Peter Pan's tights. You know, it wasn't everything.
Oh,
about
no,
him.
No,
it was just the concept of him living forever and always
being
a child.
Boy, yeah.
Right. I do. Mm. But I don't know.
But life happens.
Yeah, responsibilities life happens. You know,
take
just,
over.
It's like, yeah, you grow up eventually.
Mm.
What are you going to do?
Do you think you're ever going to get comfortable with that fear?
The fear of growing up.
Yeah, and creating a wider, like, a wider sphere for yourself to ward other people off.
The sphere has to get so big that people can come inside your circle.
And that's horrible.
Yeah, but it has to be a comfortable circle.
That's all the time we have for today's episode of Back to Reality. Whether you're an extrovert or an introvert, I hope you guys enjoyed our discussion, and I hope you guys could relate to it a little bit, and, you know that you're not alone out there. We got you. Until another episode, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabb. Let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin. يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي التي ما رايزك لتصي ديلايتك once again.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Like all U.S. Secretaries of State, Anthony Blinken's public statements overwhelmingly focus on the claim that other nations abuse human rights and that it is America's duty to defend those rights, which is very silly considering the fact that the U.S. government is the single worst human rights abuser on planet Earth. We have prepared for you an article written by Caitlin Johnson, an independent journalist based in Melbourne, Australia. The piece is titled, World's Most Tyrannical Regime Can't Stop Babbling About Human Rights. A recent tweet from the U.S. presidential Twitter account reads, America won't back away from its commitment to human rights and fundamental freedoms, claiming, no responsible American president can remain silent when basic human rights are violated. The tweet, an excerpt from the U.S. president's prepared congressional address, was retweeted on Saturday, 1st of May, by Secretary of State Antony Blinken, with the caption, we will always defend human rights at home and abroad. Like all U.S. Secretaries of State, Antony Blinken's public statements overwhelmingly focus on the claim that other nations abuse human rights and that it is America's duty to defend those rights, which is very silly considering the fact that the U.S. government is the single worst human rights abuser on planet Earth, and it's not even close. There is no other government that is circling the planet with hundreds of military bases and working to destroy any nation which disobeys it via invasion, proxy wars, blockades, economic warfare, stage coup d'etats and covert operations. There is no other government on earth whose violence has killed millions of innocent people and displaced tens of millions of people just since the turn of the century. There is no other government waging non-stop wars around the world and dropping scores of bombs per day on human beings in foreign nations in order to perpetuate its iron-fisted domination of our planet. And it just says so much about who is controlling the dominant narratives in our society that these actions are not considered human rights violations. Clearly, we should all have a human right not to be murdered by explosives dropped from the sky. And we in nations where this does not commonly occur would be very upset if it suddenly began happening to us. Clearly, it is an abuse of human rights to deliberately starve children to death because you don't approve of the people who run things in their part of the world. Clearly, it is abuse of human rights to turn a nation to rubble and chaos for profit and geostrategic control. Not a day goes by when the US government is not doing these things, both directly and indirectly, and through its imperial member states. Yet the US Secretary of State spends all day tweeting that other governments around the world are guilty of human rights violations, because as far as power is concerned, narrative control is everything. If mass murder is not an abuse of human rights, then human rights is a meaningless concept. But even if bombing campaigns and other acts of military butchery do not transgress your personal definition of human rights, the United States of America still does not care about human rights. As journalist Mark Ames recently flagged, a few years ago, the imperialist narrative managers were very keen on informing Americans that Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte was a human rights abuser, but they haven't been hearing much about what an evil brute he is of late. So what happened? Did Rodrigo Duterte cease promoting the extrajudicial killing of drug users and spontaneously transform into a cuddly human rights advocate? Of course not. What happened? As journalist Mark Ames points out, is that Duterte ceased publicly toying with the notion of pivoting from Washington to Beijing, as he had been doing since taking office, shifting to a hard line against China in support of Manila's longtime imperial overlord. We saw the change in coverage because Washington and its imperial spinmeisters only care about human rights abusers insofar as they can be exploited against the few remaining nations like China that have insisted on their own sovereignty instead of allowing themselves to be converted into member states of the US centralized empire. We know this not only from naked eye observations of the empire's behavior from year to year, but also because they have blatantly said so. As I never tire of reminding readers, a leaked 2017 State Department memo spelled out in plain English how the United States only cares about human rights when they can be weaponized against its enemies, and has a standing policy of ignoring human rights when they are committed by its allies or vassal states. In December of 2017, the website Politico published an internal memo that had been sent the previous May to the then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson by virulent neoconservative Brian Hook. The memo provided an insight into what it looks like when a toxic swamp monster orients a political neophyte to the inner mechanics of the empire, explaining the way human rights are really just a tool to be cynically leveraged to advance the goal of planetary hegemony. It reads like an old veteran explaining the backstory to the new guy in the pilot episode of a new television series. Brian Hook explained in the memo, in the case of U.S. allies such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the Philippines, the administration is fully justified in emphasizing good relations for a variety of important reasons, including counterterrorism, and in honestly facing up to the difficult trade-offs with regards to human rights. Brian Hook further wrote, one useful guideline for a realistic and successful foreign policy is that allies should be treated differently and better than adversaries. We do not look to bolster America's adversaries overseas. We look to pressure, compete with, and outmaneuver them. For this reason, we should consider human rights as an important issue with regards to U.S. relations with China, U.S. relations with Russia and North Korea. And this is not only because of moral concern for practices inside those countries, it is also because pressing those regimes on human rights is one way to impose costs, apply counter-pressure, and regain the initiative from them strategically. In imperialist terms, human rights is nothing other than a propaganda weapon to be used for building antagonistic international coalitions, manufacturing consent for invasions and regime change operations, and spinning the dominant narrative in support of starvation sanctions and world-threatening Cold War escalations. It's just mass-scale concern trolling of the most destructive and malignant sort imaginable. This is what you are feeding into, by the way, when you parrot State Department lines about how horrible and tyrannical U.S. targeted governments are. You are helping to circulate the narratives our rulers are spending billions of dollars circulating, and you are doing it for free. You are making the jobs of the imperialists that much easier, because you are unwittingly operating as a pro bono Pentagon propagandist. Don't be a Pentagon propagandist, pro bono or otherwise. Don't be an imperial concern troll. Don't let the worst human rights abuser on earth get away with pretending to support human rights.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.